You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
It's Sam Cedar, launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, November 5th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, updating us on the remarkable efforts of Occupy Sandy in bringing relief to the hardest hit areas in the New York City area, New Jersey area. Jeff Smith will be with us, who has been out on the front lines, bringing relief to areas that apparently Michael Bloomberg are not aware are in New York City. And then on the program with, well, less than 24 hours before, I was going to say the polls open, but the polls are already open. Getting reports of no sound. I'm not sure that could be their problem. Certainly within about 35 hours, we will know who the next president is. God forbid that we go through some protracted 2000 situation. But Marcos Melitzis will be with us to give us a rundown of what we can expect in terms of how this election will shake out. The oncoming right-wing freakout. Who will be happy to be talking to in the Senate? Who not? All this and more on today's program. Right-wingers already coming out with some excuses. They're either blaming the hurricane for Mitt Romney's loss, or blaming the relief efforts for supporting President Obama. And then just a heartwarming story of a bunch of kids who are literally trapped at a Romney rally, not being allowed to leave despite the fact that they are freezing. A story that I think we had touched on in September briefly, but has gotten more legs because of the conservative backlash. A report by a nonpartisan entity outlining the relationship between cutting taxes on wealthy and economic growth is forced to pull down the report by Republican senators. And what Mitt Romney's son's visit to Russia tells us about Mitt Romney, his son Matt Romney, the whole Romney ethos and the Romney chances of winning the presidency. This story is just stunning, but we have to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jeff Smith. It really is. I mean, I think we touched on this last week, but it took a couple of days to realize just how devastated parts of New York were. And as far as I can tell, in terms of relief operations, Occupy Sandy is outpacing all of the organizations. I mean, this is not to disparage any of them, but that just seems to be the case. Let's talk to Jeff Smith in just a minute to find out why that might be the case. We are right back after this. Hello, Majority Report member. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. As you know, I don't like to do ads, but free giveaway. Audiblepodcast.com/Majority Report. You can get a free downloadable audiobook. Why not go there? Get Griftopia, Bubble Machines, Vampire Squids, and The Long Con That Is Breaking America by Matt Taibbi. Seriously. Matt Taibbi's book for free, told to you at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Thanks, guys and gals.
We doing fine on the 1 and 9 line on the L. We doing 12 on the number 10 bus. We fighting bus. You know, we thorough in the burrows, cause that's a must. I remember when the juice was all gone on blitz and running home after school. A 2-play kid at lunch. I called the puppy down on Mother East Street and hit the Fulton Street Mall for the sneakers on my feet. Dear New York, I hope you're doing well. I know a lot's happened and you've been through hell. So we give thanks for providing a home. Do your kids at Ellis Island, we passed in Joe's. Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, and Staten. From the Battery to the top of Manhattan.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Jeff Smith, who's been, involved in Occupy Sandy. First off, Jeff, I mean, we spoke to Jackrabbit last Friday, who was talking about some of the things that Occupy, in conjunction, I guess, with 350.org and some other local organizations. Just tell us, I mean, who are involved in Occupy Sandy and how did it get started?
Really, it is just the you know, some of the personal contacts and the infrastructure left from the Occupy organizers from a year ago. They had continued to stay in touch and had been working on many other causes throughout the year that you don't really hear about. So, in essence, they're almost most set up to activate at a crisis situation or at a moment's notice and begin this sort of ad hoc organization. And so what you just sort of had, particularly in a part of Brooklyn that did not suffer any hurricane damage and did not lose power at all, which was in Sunset Park, you had a lot of Occupy people immediately start thinking, you know, there's a lot of people close to here. Red Hook was devastated, and obviously the outer boroughs, the Rockaways and Staten Island in particular. And so I think it's just something that Occupy has become really good at it. And the really ironic part of it is that because of the literal encampment from a year ago, those actual skills of taking in donations that people need in that sort of crisis situation were obviously quite suited to what had been presented to it. So I think it was a bit of a natural fit, but at the same time, there was a huge void that Occupy people stepped into, because there really wasn't, as far as I could tell, any institutional support happening anywhere. I mean, I spent the first 5 days of the blackout myself without power, and every day would be going out just in Manhattan and you just saw nothing. There was no Red Cross response. There was no FEMA response. Very little from the city. And if you happen to be lucky enough to be able to get power to get on the internet or to hear some of the mayor's press conferences, you had some information. But there was really no way to connect to people that were not online or that were literally trapped in their apartments. And that's really where Occupy seemed particularly adept at not only using social media and other electronic ways to get the word out, but also to really activate people in the streets and to take volunteers literally door to door and start doing that kind of canvassing work.
Yeah, I mean, it really was stunning. I mean, obviously, in the first like a couple of days, people were, if you were in Manhattan, you were stuck in Manhattan. If you were in any one of the boroughs, you were stuck there. I mean, literally, because there was no public transportation. Which you know, and when we talk about sort of informing people, it seems to me that there were multiple different ways you could do this. You leafleting, even going around in, you know, we've seen that the police department has the ability to broadcast over PA systems, mobile PA systems. It was eerie there, because to a certain extent, people were so isolated that I think it was hard for other people to realize both the magnitude of the destruction and the lack of response.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, I still really feel, because when you see the response that was taken in terms of both Con Edison and to restore power, at least primarily to the island of Manhattan, and then also the MTA's response, to me it seemed much more like there were priorities involved with the institutional support. And the reason why, you know, so many of the people that fell by the wayside in Coney Island and the Rockaways and Staten Island is because they're primarily, you know, not as affluent. And, you know, if you could get out and check into a hotel or, you know, as we saw the same in Katrina, it's really about the wealth inequality that in terms of who really suffers in these situations, that and particularly the elderly. And in both cases, it just seems like the mayor was a bit disinterested. I mean, I think the flap that came around his wanting to hold the New York City Marathon was perfectly indicative of the same kind of petulance that you saw a year ago at Occupy Wall Street. And, you know, I think it's really more about the city's, you know, unwillingness to really do something. I mean, people had joked that if it had been Al-Qaeda, you would have seen an unholy response, you know, poured into the city. And, you know, again, I mean, it was a remarkable job to get the city's, the subways up and running again in such short order. That's pretty incredible. And so I have to think that what's still going on with the power outages and the lack of response, particularly from not just FEMA, because obviously FEMA in some ways has been perhaps hollowed out or, you know, isn't even really the type of institutional force that people think it is, but the city's emergency response has been really so lacking. And although Occupy has done a remarkable job stepping in, and they're still to this day, I think it feels like the primary responders, it's an enormous logistical undertaking to try and do this. And so what I found, you know, even myself personally responding to some of these instances, a call would go out and things would be needed, and then by the time you got there, 10 other carloads had already come and they were already saying, you know, we don't need any of this anymore. And so it's not as if Occupy was, you know, perfectly set up like the best disaster management in the world. It's just that the effort and the manpower was the only thing that was being poured into that. And I think what you saw, particularly on the Lower East Side and other places, there were so many volunteers and such an outpouring of people wanting to donate things. The same as you saw with Occupy Wall Street, there is a genuine desire for people to help other people. And when there's no other place for, you know, that outlet to go, I think that people had a clear, you know, instance of who really cares about it. And I think that's what we saw a lot.
I want to touch on the specific relief efforts in a second. And I also want to get back to this notion of the sort of quiet network that Occupy has built and the implications of that going forward. But I want to just stay on this moment about Bloomberg for a minute and about the OEM, which is the Office of Emergency Management. There's Harry Siegel has written a piece in the Daily Beast. I think he went out to Staten Island and was actually looking into, you know, doing some reporting on what's happening with the OEM. But I want people to understand this for a second. I mean, I didn't even realize like the marathon was happening. I had in a million years, a week ago, I wouldn't have been able to tell you that it was happening this weekend. And when I saw that they were actually going to still have the marathon, it was almost one of those things like I couldn't even sort of digest this, that I thought it was a joke.
The disconnect was just unbelievable.
Well, I mean, can you imagine for a moment? I mean, because we have now still hundreds of thousands without power as of Saturday, and even today we have pretty close to that. In the outer boroughs, we have people in public housing surrounded by people in private housing who have power, but the public housing does not. We have elderly still stuck in homes, and we don't. Hopefully, we have been able. People have been able to be reached, but the idea that Bloomberg would have gone ahead with the marathon if, say, for some reason, inexplicable as it could be, that a huge chunk of the Upper East Side was without power and people were unreachable. Or the idea that if Battery Park was still somehow without power and they were cut off from the rest of the city, in no way implicating the running of the marathon, the idea that that would have still been held is completely impossible to imagine. It's completely impossible. The level of, and I don't mean to rant here, Jeff. We're supposed to be doing an interview. But the level of complete disregard for these people is stunning. I mean, just stunning.
And, no, you're right. I mean, in fact, the covers of the newspapers, I think the Daily News and the Post, both had images of banks of generators in Central Park that were there to keep the runners and the press covering the marathon warm. And literally, they said 400 homes in, you know, Staten Island could have been powered with those same generators. And, you know, the idea that the marathon actually runs, you know, through all five boroughs, and the start is in Staten Island. And so just even the thought of setting up and starting this enormous road race literally on the doorsteps of people who are still without power and who've lost everything and are now, you know, virtually homeless is truly stunning. It's like a novel that you probably wouldn't even believe.
The idea on day one that Bloomberg didn't go and ask the sponsors and ask the volunteers and say, all this work that you're planning to do, can we reorient this? Set up the generators for people. Get some type of feeding station. You're planning on giving all these people water who are running. Give to the people who can't get running water from their apartments. I mean, it's just beyond the pale.
There were reports of people who were in hotel rooms because they were displaced because of Sandy, being kicked out because marathon runners who were coming in from out of town had reservations.
Yeah, I mean, it's just it's just so hard to absorb it. It reads like a satire. It reads like a Terry Southern novel. But be that as it may, let's move on to the sort of the more specifics. What is it that Occupy Sandy is doing right now? And where are some of the areas which are of the greatest concern?
Well, there are a number of them. The primary hub right now is in Brooklyn at a church called St. Jacoby, which is in Sunset Park. And that's operating as sort of the main storage area where people bring donations, and then they're sorted, and then teams are sort of sent out when individual needs are identified and people go out in cars and are mobilizing to people. There's other similar types of spots like that now that have popped up. There's another one in Clinton Hill. If you go to there's a website, interoccupy.net/Occupy Sandy, that has all of these locations on there.
I think it works as occupysandy.com.
Yeah, you can go to occupysandy.com.
Okay. The same. And so you'll find there. But basically what happens is you can go there and you get a bit of an orientation, and then you'll be sent out either with other people that have cars. And not only really is it's supplies and drinking water, things like that people need, but it's also physical labor. And so people are actually just taking cleaning supplies with them and going for a day and just going house to house and helping people clean up. So it's it's that level of effort, and it really is man power intensive. So another area that was obviously really hard hit that's nearby New York City is in Red Hook. And although it's not flooded anymore, basically everything in the entire city was ruined. So if you can imagine every apartment, all the furniture soaking wet, mildewed, that sort of thing. So it's an enormous cleanup project still going on there. And then, you know, the Rockaways and Staten Island still are two of the primarily hardest hit areas. And so there are specific initiatives set up at both of those locations. But still, people should either try and go through the main hub in Brooklyn at Sunset Park, or at the very least try and get their information directly from people. Again, the hardest thing is the logistics and making sure that not too many people are going to one place and other places are left stranded. So, you know, there's a lot of hot meals that are being prepared still for these people and delivered just in mass by volunteers. That's something that, you know, FEMA and some of the other institutional support have tried to deliver. What are these kind of government issue emergency rations, which are not exactly what people are looking for after being in the dark for a couple of weeks. So even just a hot, comfortable meal and some flashlights with batteries is really important to these people who have just, you know, basically they're waiting it out. And right. As I found out, you know, when you lose power and you're going through it for a long period of time, each successive day is sort of cumulative. And the longer it goes, really the harder it gets. And so the people now that are going to face the next week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks without power, potentially, it really gets even harder for those people. So the idea that now that the rescue efforts are mostly over is probably wrong. I mean, now I think it's becoming more urgent for people that thought they could perhaps wait it out or didn't want to have to go down. I mean, a lot of these high-rise buildings, without the power, old people cannot get up and down.
That's the thing I think that people don't fully understand. I mean, you've got people, you've got 75-year-old, 80-year-old, 85-year-olds who are living on the 15th floor of these buildings. I mean, what are they going to do? You have people who use walkers. I mean, this is the thing that I think people don't understand, is that people are literally trapped there. And without a capacity to get down, it really is stunning. And so, well, let me ask you this in terms of just sort of logistics. Are there feeder locations to send supplies to those other distribution centers, A? And B, are there specific supplies that are most in need now as opposed to what was in need 5 days ago? In other words, like, I know some areas they're asking for high capacity and strong contractor bags, for instance, because to do that cleanup. And then other areas are saying no more clothes. We've got as much clothes as we can sort of absorb at this point. Other places saying more batteries and flashlights. Do you have a sense of that, or is that something we would get from the website?
The situation really seems to be pretty fluid, changing. I've definitely gotten those reports as well. I think that the upcoming winter weather, and particularly the nor'easter that people are worried about, is making the need for blankets and warm winter coats, things like that, obviously more pressing than they were before. And I think that, as far as I could see, batteries and flashlights were always at a premium. You know, and so as long as the power is going to continue to be going out, or as long as the power is out, I think those items, right, even candles to provide light, will continue to be important. But it definitely is shifting, and I think that, you know, you get a big drop off of water from the National Guard at some spot, and then all of a sudden you don't have to bring water there. But so yes, I would definitely say that it's most helpful to try and get either an actual address or location that's saying they need a particular item, or to, you know, load up your car with, as I said, a bunch of these things and head out on your own. And literally you can go door to door and just ask people, and you will find people that have not had anyone contact them, or, you know, or have been unable to get any kind of help. So, you know, I think it's odd, but really the ethic of Occupy as well is this sort of DIY instinct, and that for some people that want to volunteer in a way that's a little bit more structured, it's somewhat harder. And I think some of the centers even had people sort of just standing around and not really knowing what to do. But if you really want to jump in and, you know, take this on head first, you get some work gloves and cleaning supplies and load up your car and, you know, get to work. And so I would definitely suggest that if people go to one of these intake places, they don't be bashful and, you know, try and stake out an actual spot that you think has need and go do it. And that's really what I think the city and the institutional support doesn't seem to get, is that people don't want a clipboard or a phone number to sign up for something. They actually want stuff and someone to show up and help them. And I found that everywhere that I went helping people, you got at least that personal knowledge that people were being helped. And so,
now, lastly, there's a on Amazon, there's an Occupy Sandy and Occupy Sandy's wedding registry. What do you know about this? We have a link to it on our site. I just want you know, get a sense of what your sense is of it.
You know, I saw that as well, and I think that's a way for people to obviously try and convert their money into something that's specific that they know people will be using. I think, you know, there's been a lot of money that has been raised even by Occupy Sandy, and it's really hard to figure out how to, you know, turn that money into real help. And so I think the closer you can get to actually bringing something to one of these locations or even yourself volunteering, that's way more valuable at this point.
Right. Obviously, if somebody's living in California, is there value? Do we know enough about this registry we can feel confident that if somebody goes there and buys, you know, some blankets and or, you know, contracting bags or flashlights, toothbrushes, that it's going to get to the right place?
I mean, I don't know personally enough about it to vouch for it on that level. It's definitely being promoted by the same Occupy Sandy, you know, sources that I've been seeing and working through. So I would at the very least say I'd be far more comfortable donating to that than I would be to donating to the Red Cross or one of those types of organizations. I mean, I don't know if you heard specifically the Staten Island borough president actually excoriate the Red Cross and tell people specifically not to give their money to them. So
yeah, I think they made up after that. But
is that right? But
yes,
you know,
be that as it may. Yes, I mean, you know, one never knows. But I mean, if these are the same people engaged in this, caveat emptor, folks. But I think, you know, it's pretty clear if you're buying blankets and toothbrushes and stuff that, you know, really will have an immediate, direct impact on people.
Another positive of sending direct supplies is that gas is still very scarce here. If you get them the supplies directly to them, let Amazon spend the money getting them there, and then they don't have to use that money to get to the store.
Yes, and so we'll put that link up there, and we've routed it through the Majority Report link, and obviously we'll kick all that back into buying stuff through there. So, but you know, we just got just two more minutes, Jeff.
Sure.
I think, you know, one of the things that's really interesting about this is it shows, aside from the great work that is happening, it shows that this network that was set up by Occupy has not just real utility, but real, strength, and that it's not as if the Occupy movement just faded into the ether. It is on the ground doing more, I think, grinded out work that I think down the road is going to pay dividends.
I agree, and I think it's ironic that as reticent as Occupiers were to becoming involved in electoral politics, what their real strength is almost more so just pure grassroots politics.
Right.
And that at some point, if that network can become developed enough, it could turn into, you know, a real kind of political power that could be exercised in any way. And, you know, and the last point I want to make, and sort of tying into the issue of the election, I certainly know your position and where you are relative to the Matt Stolers of the world in terms of supporting Obama from the left. But, you know, I think the one point that maybe hasn't been underscored is that, to me, what an Obama administration really does is it separates out the true kind of progressive voices from the partisans.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that alone, I think, is valuable to be able to see, you know, when any of these issues come up where we're talking about two different systems for the rich and for the poor, it's interesting to see which people are going to line up on Obama's side versus the actual, you know, ideological consistency. And so, you know, if we had a John McCain presidency right now, you'd certainly see on MSNBC all the, you know, negatives of drone warfare, and you hear all about, you know, how he's shredding the Constitution, but then it goes away with an Obama administration. And so I think this grassroots side of Occupy Wall Street also is potentially the way that you can see a true splitting off of the partisan side of the Democratic Party from, you know, the genuine side or the true left side, and that is, you know, ultimately the end game for a change in electoral politics. And until then, I think you have to still put up with Obama, I think.
I couldn't agree with that assessment more. Jeff Smith, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us about what's going on there. And if you have any updates, please let us know, and we'll put it on the blog. We'll talk about it.
That's great. Thanks for having me, Sam.
Thanks, Jeff. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Marcos Melitis as we turn our attention to apparently there's an election tomorrow. And as you know, I get very emotional about these things. So we'll be right back. We're going to talk to Marcos Melitis. We'll be right back after this.
Tell all you fascists you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to fight to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us. This one.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to this program. Well, maybe the first guest ever. I think he may have been the very first guest before even I started in radio. He was the first guest. Like, literally, he was in our practice session from the Uber blog, Daily Kos. Marcos Melitis, welcome to the program, Marcos.
Always a pleasure, Sam. Always a pleasure. And it's been, what, 8 years?
It has been 8+ years now. 8 years, eight. 7 months.
Crazy.
And 5 days, just off the top of my head. So give us a sense of, let's start with the, basically what I want to do is I want to start with what your sense is. What we should be looking for in the presidential election, what's going to happen, who's going to win, by how much, as I race to trade sports to cash in on this. And then we'll look at some of the state races, and then we'll talk about how much we anticipate the right wing freaking out tomorrow, or I should say Wednesday. So give us your sense. Where is this presidential election going to come down to?
To me, as far as I was concerned, this race has been over in August, and that's when Obama had massive leads in all the key states that mattered. And I actually had factored in the possibility of a disaster happening that would knock Obama down, and it did. It was that first debate. But the fact is that Obama never has trailed in this race, and nothing in the last couple of days has indicated that there's any sort of momentum. In fact, any momentum Romney had after that first debate has really been gone for the last 2 weeks, no matter what they've said. And it's one of the things that Republicans used to say they took for granted was that that undecided voters would break for Mitt Romney. Actually, we're seeing the opposite. We're seeing undecided voters now break for Obama. And even in the most recent polling among undecided voters, they like Obama more. So Obama has more upside with those voters. So it's going to be I don't particularly think that there's going to be a lot of suspense in the presidential election. I think early in the night, if Virginia gets called for Obama within the first couple hours, I think that's it. I think Ohio will really clinch it, though. I'm not seeing a lot of drama in Ohio right now.
So, okay, so we're looking at the, from an electoral standpoint, it's Virginia and Ohio, and does President Obama need New Hampshire? I mean, tell us what your map looks like. So if people wanted to, are following this thing tomorrow, I mean, I imagine you do too, but I attract a tremendous amount of anxiety of people coming. I mean, I can show you some of the emails I get. People just going like, you're insane. There's no way that Obama's going to win tomorrow. And I want him to, you know, on and on. To alleviate their anxiety. So they should be watching for Virginia. How does that, what is the recipe there? We've got Kerry's states in 2004 plus what?
Basically, I mean, New Hampshire actually is kind of an odd little duck. I mean, for New Hampshire to be relevant, there has to be a lot of crazy states falling this way and that. Ain't going to happen. So New Hampshire is actually not going to really decide this election. So wherever New Hampshire goes, I wouldn't sweat it. I think it's going to go Obama, but not very relevant state. The first batch of states that are going to come in poll closing wise are going to be Virginia, North Carolina, Florida. All three of them are likely to be too close to call. So they're going to sit. I see Florida right now. Obama is just a smidgen ahead in the poll composites. Now, when I talk about polling, I talk about the composites. I don't choose and pick which poll I like. I pick them all. I average them out. Right now, Florida is basically tied. Now, given the voting shenanigans in South Florida where voters were turned away from early voting over the weekend, that could be enough to turn that election against us. So I would have been fairly optimistic, except that our people aren't being allowed to vote. But Florida again. If Florida gets called for Obama again, it's over. There's no way Romney can win without Florida. If Virginia gets called for Obama again, there's no way Romney can win without Virginia. But let's say, worst case scenario, Virginia, North Carolina, Florida go for Romney. Then you have a little handy dandy little calculator here, electoral math. You have Romney at 248 electoral votes. He still needs, even Ohio gets into 266. Again, Ohio is not going to go Romney. I mean, the polling's showing anywhere between a 3 and 5 point lead right now for Obama. And again, it's one of those states where the numbers are trending Obama's direction, not the other way around. So I'm not seeing much drama. They're not going to call it. I don't think the networks are going to call it early just because it's not going to look good. They're going to want to wait a while. But after that, though, you're looking at Michigan. Pennsylvania supposedly is competitive. It's not competitive. That'll get called early. Wisconsin, Iowa, Colorado, and Nevada, the final batch of states. Nevada, Iowa, Wisconsin are looking solidly in Obama's hands. So let's say worst case scenario, Ohio falls to Romney. He's at 266. He needs to pick up one of those other states. The most likely would be Colorado because that's the one that sort of looks pretty tied down. Again, undecided seem to be breaking Obama's direction. But that's going to be a close state. Republicans have done very well in the early voting. So I would say that that's one of the more likely states to turn red this cycle. But again, it's Romney would have to really, really run the map. And if we're looking at the polling right now and looking at sort of early voting and whatnot, Obama's going to win Virginia. Florida is a 50-50. North Carolina probably will go Romney, although we've been absolutely kicking it, killing it in the early voting. And beyond that, Wisconsin looks solidly, safely Obama. Iowa looks safely Obama. Nevada looks safely Obama. So it's a map that isn't going to be as gaudy as it was in 2008, but still Obama's team, they knew the states they needed to win. They've invested in them. They made sure they were locked down even after that first debate when his national numbers fell. Obama held steady in the battlegrounds, and now we're heading into Election Day with a great deal of momentum, real momentum, not fake momentum, but momentum you can actually see in the data at Obama's back.
All right, so there you have it, folks. Now you can how to follow this. You don't need to freak out until unless I guess Ohio. That's when people should get nervous. If for some reason that Ohio heads to Romney, this is presuming, of course, that people and I don't want to offend all of the thousands of Romney voters who I know listen to this program, but. Now, so give us a sense of the Senate. This is, you know, 2 years ago, everybody was talking about, and I certainly was one of those people saying, there's every reason to believe the Democrats are going to lose the Senate. They had three times as many candidates up for reelection. Seats, I should say, Democratic-held seats that were going to be contested as opposed to Republicans, and it doesn't look like it's going to shake out that way.
Yeah, Republicans were defending 10 seats, and Democrats were defending 31 or 32 seats. And what's more, most of the seats that Republicans were defending were in red areas, places like Alabama, Mississippi, Wyoming, Idaho, Utah. So it didn't look like the kind of environment where we're going to make gains. In fact, the discussion was, can we hold the ground? Can we hold the Senate? And particularly since this is a class of 2006, if you recall in 2006, we won the majority that year by winning a lot of states by 10,000 votes, 20,000 votes. I mean, Virginia and Montana and Missouri, these were all insanely tight states. So we had to hold these states. And again, in states like Virginia, Montana, Missouri, that actually have been tougher for Democrats in recent years. So things look really bleak. And then an amazing thing happened is that Republicans nominated a bunch of crazies. They got rid of an incredibly popular incumbent in Indiana in Dick Lugar in favor of a crazy teabagger type. Mm-hmm. You had up in Maine, we had a retirement. A safe Republican seat suddenly became in play. And we have in the aggregate now a situation where of the 10 closest races, exactly half of them, five of them, are actually Republicans. We may actually pick up, we're competitive in Arizona, Indiana, Maine, Massachusetts, that's Elizabeth Warren territory, and Nevada. That was completely almost impossible before the election began. On the flip side, a bunch of Democratic seats in tough states like West Virginia and Florida and Ohio, which were looking really difficult, suddenly are actually fairly safe and locked down. And despite Ohio's a perfect case, the super PACs, the conservative billionaires, have spent over $30 million beating up on Sherrod Brown, the Democrat. He's a freshman. He's actually a liberal firebrand in a state that's clearly not a liberal state. It's a middle-of-the-road battleground state. If anybody was in danger of super PACs and United money, it would have been Sherrod Brown. Instead, we're seeing him actually very resilient and headed towards an easier reelection. So we have a situation where we're probably going to lose a seat in Nebraska. We're probably going to lose, likely to lose seats in North Dakota and maybe Montana.
That would be Tester, right?
Yeah, John Tester in Montana. Although he pulled it up in 2006. And so you have these seats that were plausibly where we were looking at, can we maybe hold the Senate? Right now, the worst case for Democrats is that we have a status quo, that we actually just 53-47 at the end of the election, because we're going to pick up the seat in Maine. We're going to pick up the seat in Massachusetts. And it looks at this point, and I don't want to jinx it, but it looks like we may actually pick up the seat in Indiana, thanks to Richard Murdoch's talking about rape being a gift from God. So we've been gifted this horrible Republican class of candidates and just a horrible Republican message. I mean, it's been a godsend to us. And we may actually come out of this best case scenario, you may come out of this with a plus four, a 57-43 Senate. Now, a lot of things would have to, you know, go right for that to happen. I'm not going to count on that. My best guess right now is that maybe we pick up one seat, that we go to 54-46, which, given the map that we had and the pre-election picture, if we don't lose seats, would be an insanely incredible victory for the Democrats.
So where do you think, there's a chance for Tammy Duckworth in Wisconsin? Where do you think that fourth seat would come? I mean, we have Maine, Massachusetts, potentially Indiana. Do you think?
Tammy Baldwin in
Baldwin,
Wisconsin,
right,
and she's looking pretty good, but that we already held that seat. So that's not a pickup. That was one of those difficult holds. And fingers crossed, but it's looking really good.
Cole, right. So where do you think we'll pick that up, that fourth seat?
Our possibilities, I mean, right now, Maine is a pickup. Massachusetts is a pickup. That's two.
Right.
That'll offset, that'll be partly offset by Nebraska, which would be minus one. After that, we're actually very competitive in the remaining seats. We may actually even hold on to North Dakota. It's close enough, and the Democratic candidate is good enough where we may actually hold it. So that may actually be one of the most likely one of the most likely maps, where we lose Nebraska, we pick up Maine, we pick up Massachusetts. Now we may pick up Indiana. I'm feeling pretty good about Indiana, and I'm not feeling that great about North Dakota. Again, that leaves us as plus one. So both of those scenarios are actually quite plausible. I think Arizona's getting away from us. I'm not sure we'll pick up Arizona. In Nevada, Nevada is one of those tricky states. The last three cycles, the polling has been horribly off because they don't know how to poll Latinos. And it's just going into the 2010 election, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid was supposed to lose by about 2 to 3 points. That's what the polling said. He won by five.
Right
now, our candidate in Nevada, Shelley Berkeley, is losing by 2 to 3 points. Does that mean that this polling disaster will repeat itself and she'll win? You know, past performance is no guarantee of future, what happens in the future. So I'm not going to sit there and say the polls are wrong again, but they have been wrong. So I'm cautiously optimistic about it. But right now, just looking at the data, I would have to say that we're not going to win it. But again, the data's been horribly wrong in Nevada for three cycles in a row.
All right. So let's move to the House briefly. There's little chance the Democrats, if any, they're going to pick up or going to take control of the House, I think, at this point. And the question is, will they pick up any seats at all? What's your sense? I mean, we've talked about the reasons quite a bit on this program. I think the overriding one is probably the redistricting that took place in following the 2010 census. There's also, I guess, part of that is also we lost some opportunities in California with their new primary system. But give me a sense if you think there were other reasons, if the deep triple C did a decent job, and what you think the outlook looks like.
Yeah, it's been one of those weird – the House has been very strange, because we've seen, obviously, in the Senate, we've seen the numbers moving in a Democratic direction. Obviously, Obama did very well over the summer. He had his hiccup after the first debate, but he's rebounded. He's headed to what looks like a comfortable reelection victory. The House, though, when you look at the House generic polling, where you ask people you're polling, are you going to vote for the Democrat or the Republican? And it's been pretty much deadlocked to a very slight Democratic advantage the entire cycle. To pick up the House, we would have had to have about a 5 to 10 point lead in that generic polling. We haven't had that. And I'm not quite sure I understand why or quite grasp in what the dynamics are there. But part of it is the redistricting, obviously. They shored up their most vulnerable incumbents. Part of it is actually, I think, Citizen United money, Super PAC money. Doesn't have a lot of effect at the presidential level. We haven't seen it have a lot of effect at the Senate level. I actually do think it's having an effect down ballot, where people aren't as well known. And obviously, congressmen and women aren't very well known. They're sort of down ballot. I think money has a factor in it. Right now, I would say maybe about a 10, 12 seat pick is what we're seeing. So we're going to make gains. I have no doubt about that. The issue is, are we going to get to 25? We're not going to get to 25.
Right. And what about Michelle Bachmann? Do you have a sense of whether she is going to exit stage, I guess, right? Stage crazy, Crazyville?
Stage way out there. It's a conservative district. It's a Republican district. The fact that that race is even competitive just shows how terrible of a candidate she has become, how out of touch she has with her district. I mean, they're clearly sick of her enough to overcome the Republican tilt of that district. Tough to say, but I got to say, there's a ton of money pouring into that district from both sides. I mean, they all see it as Republicans definitely feel the heat. I would give the edge to Bachmann just based on the demographics of her district. But the fact that this thing is even competitive makes me doubt my prediction. It could very well, she could be knocked out. I'd love to see her knocked out. Steve King in Iowa, Alan West in Florida, and Joe Walsh in Illinois. And Joe Walsh is a goner. Alan West, that district looks, that race looks 50-50, man. That's tough. And I haven't seen any numbers out of that Iowa race with Vilsack, Christine Vilsack, yeah. and Kings. So I'm not sure what's going on there. But given that the numbers in Iowa in general are trending towards Obama's direction, that actually, and I'm hopeful there. But if we were able to knock out three of those four, that would be a successful night for me.
Do you think, I mean, when I think of what surprises me about Congress, even knowing the sort of the structural difficulties that Democrats faced in this election, you know, the redistricting and also the, I think you're absolutely right about the Citizens United money. I think it makes a much bigger impact in these races. You know, you can come in with $1 million, you can buy all sorts of ad time in a lot of these districts. You can really just inundate people with it. But do you think that there was – it seems to me that part of the problem was that Paul Ryan was not nationalized enough. Like some of – like Medicare and Social Security, which seemed to me to be the most sort of bread and butter, most easily digestible issues for people running for Congress, were not exploited. Paul Ryan was just simply not exploited enough, and perhaps by President Obama, for it to filter down to congressional races.
Yeah, no, clearly that didn't happen. And the fact that Democrats have an advantage on Medicare, but it's not a major advantage, is part of the problem. I mean, they should have been able to ride it. Now, the reality, though, and this is frustrating as a liberal, is that one of the Democratic super PACs, Priorities, did a focus group, and he basically told the attendees what the Ryan plan was.
Right.
And then they said Mitt Romney, you know, he supports all of this. And the focus group recipients thought it was so ludicrous that they refused to believe it. They treated it as just, oh, it's just political nonsense, lies, because it was so crazy to them that they just did not believe it was true. And I suspect this is what's happening in all these districts where Democrats talk about Democrats want to eliminate Medicare. And people think that's just such a crazy thing that nobody would actually want to get rid of Medicare that they refuse to believe it. And then the Republicans have done a decent job of muddying the waters with the 8,000 times where they claim Democrats cut Medicare by $700 billion, blah, 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 right? So they have they muddied the water, and Democrats sort of seem to back off. And I think – I don't know if they saw in their polling or their focus groups that people just weren't buying it and they didn't press their advantage. But clearly they didn't do the job in communicating that to voters. And if there's one big failure in the Democratic strategy this year, that is exactly it. And I think you pinpointed it.
I would add that, you know, we had like a week after Paul Ryan was picked, Joe Biden got out there, was in a couple, he did this twice in one day. He was in a couple of cafes. I think it was in Ohio. I'm not sure. Maybe it was Pennsylvania. And he basically said, I guarantee you our administration will not make any cuts whatsoever to Social Security. I flat out guarantee you, he said. And since that day, those words have not been repeated. We've heard, we will not privatize it. We've heard we have no difference between it. I think that was a massive failure. And it's also a scary failure going forward, because I think the only reason why you don't exploit that in the campaign is if you have a weird integrity, to the idea that you need to create some space to actually go ahead and make some, you know, tweaks to, you know, cut 5 or 10, 15, 20% of an old person's pension down the road, it seems to me, which I think there's a real electoral price that is going to be paid at the very least on the House level, I think, because of it. And I think it should set off alarm bells for everybody. But beyond that, tomorrow, you are, I don't know, you know, I know people, there are people who are more into the numbers and to the elections than someone like you, but most of them got their start at your site anyways. So who will you be following tomorrow? Of course, we got live blogs at Daily Kos, but what Twitter feeds, what sites will you be following tomorrow? In other words, pro tips time.
Greg Rowe. Daniel.
Greg Rowe?
These are Twitter handles. Joe Ralston in Nevada. There's a couple of local journalists in some of these key states that can actually really give some context to the numbers. But I got to say, the elections team and the elections team at Daily Kos is sort of a all-star of a bunch of people around the web that were really good at elections data crunching. So Daily Kos elections, we're going to have an absolute fantastic number of people. They got their spreadsheets fired up, literally their spreadsheets, where they're going to be pumping in numbers and then doing projections based on those numbers on where each state should fall. So we're going to have quite the group of people at Daily Kos. Obviously, I'm also following about 500 people on Twitter, and I got to say that stream, it's going to be running fast and furious, but there's some good data that comes out of that, so I'll be retweeting a lot of the best stuff too.
Greg Rowe, Joe Ralston, is that what you said?
Yeah. And D. Taniel. What's his Taniel Twitter?
Now, people don't realize this, but
it's just Taniel, T-A-N-I-E-L.
And well, great, we got that one. People don't realize that that Nate Silver got his start at Daily Kos as Poblano doing the same type of number crunching.
It's Daily Kos. It's a haven for numbers and stats geeks. I mean, that's why we call ourselves the reality based community, because we're not going on gut feeling here. I mean, this is based on the data. My certainty, just like Nate Silver's certainty, is based on numbers. Now, there's always the off chance that every poll is wrong and conservatives are right that every poll is wrong. Not really likely, because I trust the data, and it's I've gotten in trouble in my election prognostications when I've stopped trusting the data and I've tried to rationalize why it's not looking as good for Democrats. They're doing exactly everything that I've done wrong in the past where I've screwed up, and they're going to have egg in their face after tomorrow.
How crazy do you think the right wing is going to become on Thursday? I mean, assuming that we have results by Tuesday into Wednesday, they're in shock. I guess, you know, like you have like a 24-hour period where I think like you're just in total shock. But how crazy do you think they're going to become on Thursday? Because this is, I mean, this is, I remember how crushing 2004 was. We all anticipated that Kerry was going to win. There were exit polls. We were convinced of it. Maybe this is what you're pointing to in terms of data, because now when I go back and I look at those polls, I go, it didn't
look that good.
it was only three polls that I must have ignored every other poll.
Exactly.
But
that's where I got in trouble. They're already kind of crazy.
Apparently something like 80% of Romney voters are convinced he's going to win.
Yeah, no, they're in trouble. And that's certain. I mean, it's a difference between us in 2004 and us in 2010. I mean, we knew we were going to lose in 2010. We didn't try to rationalize it away or create an alternate reality. And yeah, 2010 sucked, but I didn't wake up the next day crushed. You know, I knew it was coming. We were prepared. So they're not prepared for what's coming up, which is going to make it more. I'm going to enjoy it more, I got to say. I'm going to get some sadistic pleasure out of that. But they're already making excuses and already.
Right, it's a hurricane. It's
it's a hurricane. I mean, Eric Erickson, I don't know if you saw this at Red State, but he's a CNN guy too. He's on CNN. He said it didn't matter who won because the rapture's coming.
I saw that 50,000 feet. I've got here it is, 50,000 feet looking down.
The rapture's coming, so who cares? You have people like Vic Morris, who was so certain because he had the secret poll that was the one true poll of all polls that had Romney winning in a landslide. Now he's hedging, and of course he's blaming Sandy, just like a lot of these other people are. But they're starting to hedge because they've gone out on this limb, and they're going to get sawed off. I mean, they're nuts. I mean, even if by some miracle Romney were to pull this off, it wouldn't be a landslide. There's just no way in hell it's going to happen. So they have to start walking back. But the crazies online, I mean, there's one thing about the ones who are on CNN and I guess I'd say it because the Fox ones are seeing what is online. They are absolutely 100% convinced. So I'm looking forward to the civil war. I'm looking forward to the Romney was too liberal,
yeah.
Even though nobody's going to sort of pay attention that Romney gained in the polls when he moved to the left. I mean, he was getting killed when he was a severe conservative.
All right. The first debate was all about Mitt Romney finally making that turn to the center. He actually got to the left on President Obama on a couple of things. And there's no doubt in my mind that they're going to move further to the right. Let me ask you this quickly. Joe Biden, again, the other day, repeated what President Obama said, has said multiple times. He said it before the 2010 election. He said it again. And that is, when the Republicans win, they're going to realize that now they have to deal. Do you think that's the case? I mean, I'm very uptight about the grand bargain, and that and I'm not going to talk too much about it now because we'll have plenty of time to talk about it in the next 2 days.
That's our civil war.
And exactly. And why do you think Joe Biden says that? Is it just because they think, to the extent that there are any undecided voters out there, they want to hear this notion of we can get along after the election?
Yeah, people like that bipartisan crap. The undecided voters, people who don't pay attention to this shit, so they don't know that there aren't two sides that are completely 100% opposed and one side is batshit insane. They don't know this. So, and I realized this. I mean, this is amazing. Did you watch the debates with the CNN dial focus group?
Yeah.
All right. Every time either Biden or Obama attacked, or even Romney for that matter.
Yep.
The numbers went down. And these were undecided voters, right? Idiots, essentially. And they just want everybody to get along because they couldn't be bothered to pay attention to what's happening. And for whatever reason, some of it is legitimate. People are having difficult lives.
Well, I mean, it's easy. Whenever there's conflict, it means that they actually have to engage more. And they are definitionally people who don't want to engage in politics.
So you have a situation where the 2-3%, 5% that are undecided at this point, that's the crowd. They don't want to hear attacks. They want to hear about how we're all going to get along and sing Kumbaya and be wonderful, and which is why Romney's been talking about how bipartisan he is, even though his record of that is zero. And that's why Obama and Biden are, because the few that are left are that crowd. They don't want to hear conflict, so you can't give them anything. And at this point, if you don't have your bases with you, you know, you're SOL, so you better have your bases with you. You know, so the red meat has to go out and all the BS about bipartisanship. Obama won big on this. And part of the problem that I saw in the last 4 years is that he actually believed it. And I'm hoping that the new second term Obama is going to be less naive about Republicans wanting to work with him.
Yeah. I hope that naivete is gone. I also hope some of his political leanings have also gone away, but I'm not so convinced about that, but we shall see. I suspect you're right that there will be a bit of, at the very least, a civil tussle in the context of those of us on the left with this whole grand bargain thing. But, That's we've got plenty of time to save keep our powder dry for that. Tomorrow will be the big day. Marcos, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks so much.
Marcos Melitzas, folks, check out the Daily Kos. You will find there all sorts of, it really is. They're obsessive. They've got guys there with spreadsheets and whatnot, and you know, who else are you going to go to?
Unskewed polls.
Unskewedpolls.com. All right, folks. Not sure who will be the guest on tomorrow, but We're going to put up that link to the Occupy Sandy registry. It basically allows you to donate stuff there. You heard Jeff's take on it. You know, the upshot of a Red Cross is that supposedly it's certified and it is regulated. The downside is you still don't know exactly what they're doing with the money, if they're doing a good job. I'm going to tell you that I will make that I will buy some supplies for Occupy Sandy through this. But you know, just be careful and do this with your eyes open. I'm fairly confident that if I buy blankets there, it's going to end up for people who need it. So,
and Occupy Sandy's working with other, like, I guess you could say, more legit
institutional, but that's not even the issue to me.
Like New York Change they're working with and other organizations like that.
The issue for me is really not so much that I found this through a Twitter, through a tweet.
Yeah, that's what I mean, though. Like, it's connected to other things that make it real. Like, it's not a scam.
Right. No. I think Occupy Sandy is, and I just want to make sure that the wedding registry.
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, I think people can be fairly confident in this situation. And it's obviously, if you're in town and you have the ability to get there, do that. That's better. But if you don't, this works quite well. And if you're feeling super flush, become a member of the Majority Report. I don't know. I don't want to compete with that today. But voting for the podcastawards.com at podcastawards.com, that won't cost you anything, and it'll make Matt happy. Matt's very upset when I don't pitch it. So podcastawards.com, we're going for People's Choice and News and Politics. They will send you an email to confirm your vote. You got to click on that link. It'll just take a second to confirm your vote. And you can vote every day. And I got news for you. You know, those guys at Free Libertaria or whatever the show is, you know they're doing that. Right? What shows are we competing against?
Well, we got in the politics news section, I think we're up against, I don't even remember.
Yeah, there's none, screw them.
Yeah.
All right, folks, so get on it. And
on top of it, if you're a listener of other liberal progressive podcasts like Citizen Radio or Young Turks, we're not competing against them in this.
That's
so
right.
So you could still vote for them in their categories and still vote for us.
And you can vote for what's-his-face, Marin.
Well, no, because he's up against Citizen Radio.
Oh, yeah. Come on. Marin, apparently in his show, Judd Hirsch is his dad. I hope I'm not telling secrets out of the people. Are people aware of that? Gina Gershon, I guess, is his girlfriend. I can't wait for this to end in disaster. No, I mean, I'm not telling stories out of it. That's public knowledge, isn't it? I don't know.
You can help hurricane relief at Occupy Sandy.
There you go. All right, folks. See you in the better half of the program.